This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast, giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 71, Tate Thurman. On the morning of February 18, 2020, EMS responded to a home in East Peoria, Illinois, on a report of a child in cardiac arrest. At the scene, they found 4-year-old Tate Thurman unresponsive with multiple injuries, including bruises covering his little body from head to toe. Leslie Ann Jett, the live-in girlfriend of Tate's father, told police that Tate had been injured when he slipped in some water on the floor and fell, but Tate's injuries told a completely different story. When Tate died after 2 days on life support, an autopsy was conducted, revealing massive internal bleeding caused by high-velocity blunt force trauma. Leslie was subsequently arrested and charged with Tate's murder. Her trial, 16 months later, revealed disturbing and gut-wrenching details of Tate's final weeks, as well as Leslie's true colors, as she attempted to pin the blame for Tate's death on both her ex-husband and Tate's own 7-year-old brother. This is the horrific story of Tate Thurman. Before I get into the episode, I'd like to give a shout-out to my newest patrons, Amberly from Colville, Utah, and Nancy M. and Gina M. from a galaxy far, far away. Thank you all so much, and thank you to all of my patrons. Your support brings me closer to my goal of dedicating myself full-time to the podcast and the blog, and I'm truly grateful for every last one of you. If you'd like to support the show, you can visit patreon.com/stlcpod, where you can pledge as little as $3 a month. For a pledge of $10 a month and up, you'll get access to a small but growing collection of Patreon-exclusive bonus minisodes, in which I tell the stories of even more kids who deserve to be remembered. Let's get right into the story of one such little boy, whose case I've been following on Suffer the Little Children blog since shortly after he died. Tate's story is reminiscent of another child I've covered at length, and that's 5-year-old AJ Frund, another precious, blonde-haired boy from Illinois who died covered in a multitude of injuries that couldn't have occurred during a single incident of abuse. Like AJ, Tate's family had a long history with the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS, and also like AJ, Tate suffered more during his few short years than most people suffer in a lifetime. I'll start with the story as we knew it from the beginning, and then I'll get into the heartbreaking details we learned during this month's trial. At approximately 9:10 a.m. on February 18, 2020, emergency medical personnel responded to a call reporting a child in cardiac arrest at 109 Jefferson Court in East Peoria, Illinois. At the scene, they discovered 4-year-old Tate Thurman unresponsive with serious injuries, including bruises from head to toe, according to East Peoria Police Chief Steve Rogge. Due to the suspicious nature of the injuries, after just minutes on the scene, EMS contacted police. Meanwhile, Tate was rushed to OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria, where he was placed on life support. Investigators questioned the only adult present at the time of the incident, 33-year-old Leslie Ann Jett, the live-in girlfriend of Tate's father, Jeremy Thurman, who was at work in Urbana when his son was fatally injured. Leslie told police that Tate slipped in some water on the floor, fell, and immediately became unresponsive. She also mentioned that Tate had fallen down the stairs the previous week. Only Leslie, Tate, and Leslie's sleeping 2-year-old were in the home at the time of the incident. The 2-year-old and Tate's older brother, who I'll call JT, were immediately placed into protective custody. 2 days after the 911 call, at 9:05 p.m. on Thursday, February 20th, Tate was declared brain dead. The decision was made to keep him on a life-supporting ventilator, according to Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood, until his organs were donated. Coroner Harwood later said, "I went up to the hospital the night he was pronounced brain dead and did an initial examination on Tate and shot over 100 photographs looking at the injuries,
And I knew what was reported to us was not consistent to that, but what was consistent was abuse.
After Tate was removed from life support, an autopsy was conducted on February 24th by the Peoria County Coroner's Office. It was later revealed that while most autopsies take about 75 to 90 minutes, Tate's took 5 hours, 3 of which were spent examining his multitude of external injuries. Tate's autopsy showed that the little boy had suffered a horrendous amount of pain caused by various injuries, including tears to his intestines that appeared to be the result of
high-velocity blunt force trauma.
He was covered from head to toe in bruises and suffered from a pancreatic hematoma that caused internal bleeding. Court documents stated even more graphic descriptions of Tate's injuries.
Deep muscular bruising of the abdominal wall and back, an acute fracture of the right collarbone, and extensive contusions and abrasions to his scalp, face, neck, chest, genital area, buttocks, upper back, shoulder, and limbs, including deep muscular bruising of the scalp, neck, and torso.
Tate likely slipped into a coma within 30 minutes of the injury that caused his internal bleeding. I cannot imagine how painful and terrifying those 30 minutes were for that little boy. On Wednesday, February 26th, East Peoria police executed a search warrant on the home. At 4:34 p.m. the same day, they found Leslie in the passenger seat of a vehicle in Crèvecœur and arrested her without incident at a gas station. She was booked into Tazewell County Jail and assigned a public defender, named in court documents as Sam Snyder. At a press conference held on February 27th in East Peoria City Hall, Tazewell County State's Attorney Stuart Umholtz condemned individuals who had illegally posted confidential juvenile records pertaining to the case on social media, warning the posters that they are not necessarily anonymous and that they may face consequences for their actions. He asked that others refrain from spreading confidential information of this nature, as it may impede the investigation and prosecution of the case. The information in question has since been removed. Umholtz said,
"It was immediately apparent to fire and rescue that this case was not, as Ms. Jett described it, as a slip and fall. And make no mistake about it, this is an abuse case."
Initially, Leslie's charges were unknown.
"I don't mind the defendant, the accused, sitting in jail, not knowing the answer to that question. But a child murder, that gets my attention, that keeps me up at night. Our community is a victim anytime a child is murdered."
East Peoria Police Chief Steve Rogie said at the conference,
"Rescue personnel also told police that Tate was covered in bruises from head to toe, and the nature of the call was suspicious. At the original time the call came in, only Leslie Jett, Tate, and 2-year-old male were present in the home, and the 2-year-old was still sleeping when officers arrived."
At the same press conference, Coroner Jamie Harwood said,
"On February 20th at 9:05 p.m., Tate Thurman was pronounced brain dead at St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. He remained on ventilatory support, commonly known as life support, for procurement of organs for donation. Autopsy results demonstrated that Thurman suffered multiple blunt force trauma injuries that were grossly inconsistent with the reported mechanism. Due to the nature of the injuries, is being ruled a homicide."
At the press conference, a reporter asked Chief Rogie if Tate's father, Jeremy Thurman, was a suspect in the case. Chief Rogie responded that the abuse was
not a one-time thing
and that police were still investigating. Umholtz stressed that the goal of his office was successful prosecution, and he hoped they could find jurors who would be honest, fair, and unbiased, despite news reports and false information being spread on social media. Tate's private funeral was held the same day as the press conference, his remains cremated after the service. Leslie, whose bond was set at $3 million, was ultimately charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, each with its own specification, and a felony charge of aggravated battery to a child under the age of 13. If convicted, she faced up to 100 years in prison on one of the murder charges alone. On Thursday, March 19, 2020, Leslie appeared in court via closed-circuit video monitor. Tazewell County Judge Catherine Gorman read the charges against her, to which Leslie pleaded not guilty. Looking gaunt and wearing her long dark hair in a ponytail, Leslie nodded in agreement when public defender Luke Taylor said she planned to hire a private attorney. Court records indicated shortly thereafter that Leslie retained attorney Bridget E. Bork, although that would soon change yet again. Many of Leslie's court appearances leading up to the trial took place via closed-circuit video due to COVID-19 restrictions. Adding to the disturbing nature of the case, here's the part where news organizations and the public alike compared Tate's death to the murder of 5-year-old A.J. Friend of Crystal Lake in April of 2019. DCFS first became involved with Tate's family in 2011, 4 years before Tate was even born, and the agency would investigate the family several times before Tate's death. After pressure by the public and the media to provide more information about the agency's involvement with the family, DCFS released a statement and a timeline of events.
Director Smith and DCFS staff at every level are completely devastated by the sudden loss of Tate Thurman, who was just 4 years old when he died 2 weeks ago. The tragic incident that led to his death is heartbreaking, and DCFS is fully cooperating with law enforcement as we investigate what took place. Our department is committed to being as transparent as possible as this investigation moves forward, while also protecting the privacy of Tate's siblings and family. We serve families in times of extreme crisis, and our top priority will always be protecting them and ensuring they have the support they need to recover.
The timeline of the agency's involvement is as follows, including additional information I was able to find via public online sources. On October 1, 2011, Jessalyn Alora Thurman was born to then 26-year-old Tara Foley and 25-year-old Jeremy Thurman. Tara already had a son, who I'll call TF, from a previous relationship. Just days after Jessalyn's birth, Tara and Jeremy awoke to discover the baby unresponsive in their bed. She was taken to OSF St. Francis Medical Center, where, at 8:47 a.m. on October 13, 2011, Jessalyn was pronounced dead. Her death, according to then-Peoria County Coroner Johanna Ingersoll, was caused by positional asphyxia related to co-sleeping. DCFS determined that the infant died due to an unsafe sleep environment. Jessalyn was buried in Roberts Cemetery in Morton. Over the following 6 years, there were 7 more DCFS investigations. During that time, Tara and Jeremy had 2 more children, first JT in 2013, and then Tate, who was born on December 3, 2015, just 2 years and 2 days apart from his older brother. Tara reportedly lost guardianship of her children several times, although the reason for this is unknown, as are the reasons for each of the 7 investigations from 2011 through 2017. Court records, however, show that the relationship between Tara and Jeremy was fraught with domestic violence and instability. A week after Jessalyn's death, Jeremy obtained an emergency order of protection against Tara, which was dropped less than a month later. In January of 2012, Jeremy was charged with domestic violence battery, causing bodily harm. He pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of domestic violence, so his penalty was only a fine. 2 years later, in May of 2014, Jeremy obtained another emergency order of protection against Tara, and 2 days afterward, Tara tried to obtain one against Jeremy, which was denied due to Jeremy's open case. Jeremy's order of protection was granted, but it was dismissed a month later. Next, in May of 2017, Jeremy was charged with battery, pleaded guilty, and spent a few days in jail. The same month, he received another emergency order of protection against Tara, which was dismissed the following month. A month after that, Jeremy was charged with criminal trespass, to which he again pleaded guilty. For that offense, he spent 2 days in jail and 6 months on probation. In December of 2017, another tragedy befell the family. Tara underwent surgery on December 11th to correct a previous hernia surgery and address a second hernia. During the 2 days following her surgery, she was in severe pain, which is documented in several posts on her Facebook page. On December 13th, at age 32, Tara Shea Foley died in her home of an accidental drug overdose, leaving behind her 3 sons and Jeremy, who was described in her obituary as her soulmate. After Tara's death, JT and Tate were returned to their father's custody. When that case was closed, DCFS had no further contact with the family until Tate's death on February 18, 2020. There is no history of DCFS involvement with Leslie Jett or her 2-year-old child. Child advocates say problems with the system caused DCFS to fail both Tate and AJ. Cook County Public Guardian Charles Goldberg told CBS Chicago,
"DCFS let Tate down, and now he's dead. If we have transparency and compare what went wrong in Tate's case to what went wrong in AJ's case, we can hopefully move forward to that reform."
Time will tell if DCFS will shoulder any of the blame for Tate's death or if any further details of their involvement or potential culpability will be released to the public. A GoFundMe campaign was created by a close family friend, Christina Caudill, to help pay for Tate's headstone. In the description, Christina stated that any additional donated funds would be held in accounts for Tate's older brothers to access when they're older and managed in the meantime by their maternal grandparents. The last public post on Leslie Jett's Facebook page, which was briefly deactivated after her arrest, was made in February of 2020. Her page is full of reposts about tattoos, motherhood, and marijuana, as well as countless photos of her toddler son and even a few of Jeremy's older son. I thought it was extremely telling that I found only a single public photo featuring Tate, and that was a family photo taken in April of 2019, before Leslie even moved in with the Thurmans. I'll include that photo in the Facebook album for this episode. Leslie apparently cycled through a few attorneys after her arrest. She requested a public defender on February 28, 2020, and was initially assigned public defender Sam Snyder, but he entered a motion to withdraw a few months later. By late 2020, Leslie's first retained attorney, Bridget E. Bork, was listed as inactive on Leslie's case on the Tazewell County Circuit Court portal. At trial, Leslie was represented by retained attorneys Hugh Toner and Michael Brandt. If you're like me, you're a bit overwhelmed by all of the teeth whitening products on the market. This next sponsor has provided me with some very interesting facts to pass on to you. Fact 1, teeth whitening does not whiten your teeth. It removes the stains and restores the tooth to its natural color. Natural colors vary per person, but for most, it's an off-white or slightly yellowish undertone. Fact 2, teeth whitening does not damage teeth, but it does temporarily dehydrate. When dehydrated, the pores in the enamel are open and exposed. Open pores invite acids and sugars, which, as we all know, lead to tooth decay. Avoid or minimize acidic and sugary substances for at least 24 hours after whitening. Also, avoid staining substances as the teeth are more susceptible to restaining during this period. Fact 3, tooth sensitivity is the result of tooth dehydration. When the pores of the enamel are open, the teeth become dehydrated, exposing the nerve to the elements. As the tooth rehydrates, the sensitivity will dissipate. To accelerate the rehydration and curb sensitivity, use a post-whitening application known as remineralization or desensitizing gel. Fact 4, caps and veneers cannot be whitened because they do not have pores for the stains to latch to. Prior to having dental work, you should whiten your teeth, restoring them to their natural color, as the dentist will be color matching to your current shade. Fact 5, the key to teeth whitening is the delivery device. So as long as a whitening product is a peroxide-based whitener, it will remove the stains. What differentiates one product from the next is the device that holds the whitening agent to the tooth without interruption. Whitening strips neglect the crevices and molars, and they slide on your teeth. Saliva floods the generic trays because they are bulky and do not create a seal. Oh, and you likely did not know this, but LED lights are novelty items that add no benefit. You need a high-output UV light only found at the dentist. Don't fall for the gimmick. If you insist on a light that does not work, get one on Amazon for under $5. The number one whitening device recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray. You can have your dentist make you trays for $300 to $600, or you can head over to smilebrilliant.com and use their lab direct mail-in process for a fraction of the price you would pay at the dentist. Oh, and if you grind your teeth at night, you can also purchase Smile Brilliant's custom-fitted night guards, once again, for a fraction of the price the dentists charge. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com, and use my coupon code CHILDREN for an exclusive Suffer the Little Children discount. The trial of Leslie Ann Jett for the murder of 4-year-old Tate Thurman began with jury selection on Monday, June 28, 2021. Tazewell County Circuit Court Judge Paul Gilfillan had previously cautioned both sides that the trial could take 2 weeks or even longer. In her opening statement on Tuesday, June 29, Assistant State's Attorney Mara Mishler, who represented the state at trial along with Assistant State's Attorney Sarah Schreier, told the court that Tate's heart stopped due to blunt force trauma.
That cardiac arrest deprived his brain of oxygen, eventually leading to his death. A pediatric child abuse specialist pediatrician will also be testifying. She specifically found Tate's injuries to be consistent and diagnostic of inflicted child physical abuse.
Leslie's defense attorney, Hugh Toner, also gave his opening argument, mumbling almost incoherently as he told the court,
"I don't believe you're ever going to show anybody who will ever say they saw Leslie hit or abuse Tate or anybody else."
Does that mean, first of all, that when you asked Leslie what happened, and she said, "He came in and he slipped and fell," does that make that untrue?
After both sides presented their arguments, first responders took the stand in succession to testify about the events of the morning of February 18, 2020. According to East Peoria paramedic Dan Turner, he was dispatched to 109 Jefferson Court at 9:12 a.m. on the morning in question, arriving less than 2 minutes after the initial call, reporting a
4-year-old in cardiac arrest.
When he arrived, Mr. Turner said Tate was lying on his back in the living room, unresponsive, wearing only a pair of underwear, stained yellow. Tate, he said, was dry, and he saw no water on the floor, despite Leslie's claim that Tate had slipped and fallen in a puddle. Mr. Turner described Tate's condition, saying the little boy's core was warm and his extremities cold, signaling that there had
not been a significant amount of downtime.
Dan Borscheit, a senior paramedic for East Peoria, also testified that neither Tate nor Leslie was wet when he responded to the scene. He said Leslie told him Tate
runs into things constantly and something about a concussion.
Both paramedics testified they were in the house for under 3 minutes before rushing Tate to the hospital. Also on the stand on day one of the trial was Illinois State Police crime scene investigator Aaron Bowers, who arrived at the hospital to take photos of Tate at 2:28 p.m. on February 18th. As she testified, the prosecution showed the jury the graphic photos of injuries all over Tate's body. Ms. Mishler told them,
"We take no pleasure in showing you those photographs, but they are important. They are very important to this case for you to understand the extent of the injury that Tate suffered."
On Wednesday, June 30th, medical experts dominated the witness stand, including OSF pediatric intensivist Dr. Jonathan Gelbach, who explained to the court that Tate's injuries were inconsistent with Leslie's slip-and-fall story.
Tate's bruises were scattered throughout the body, couldn't be explained by one or two direct contacts, but they seemed like they would have been more consistent with multiple different forceful entrances.
Bruises really on various different surfaces on the body, on the head and face, on the torso, on the back, on the extremities. When we have one explanation or even two explanations for how injuries might have occurred from an example such as a fall, but there are injuries on multiple different surfaces of the body that aren't consistent with that one or even two mechanisms, that would raise concern.
When Tate arrived at the hospital, the doctor said he had no heartbeat.
That is as critical as it gets.
Internal bleeding had caused a buildup of lactic acid, which caused Tate's cardiac arrest. Dr. Anthony Munaco, pediatric surgeon at OSF Children's Hospital of Illinois, also testified, saying he conducted a CT scan and two surgeries on Tate's abdomen due to multiple injuries to his intestines, including a large 8 to 10-inch tear in the mesentery, which is a double-folded membrane that attaches the intestines to the abdominal wall and is difficult to injure, according to Dr. Munaco.
You need a very large force to be able to kind of disrupt that tissue. So similar such mechanism of injuries would be very high-speed motor vehicle collision with an improperly worn seatbelt.
Regarding the timing of Tate's injuries, Dr. Munaco opined that they couldn't have occurred more than 3 hours prior to the surgery he performed, and that Tate would have lost consciousness no longer than 30 minutes after the internal bleeding began. Tate's large force trauma injuries, he said, did not likely occur all at once.
I do not think they could have come from a single blow. I believe it would be from repeated strong force blows to the abdomen.
As for Leslie's version of the story that Tate had fallen down the stairs a week before his death, Dr. Munaco said the little boy's spleen was intact, which would not likely be the case in a fatal stair fall. Both doctors testified about talking to Jeremy Thurman and Leslie Jett about Tate's
severe prognosis,
saying Jeremy was distraught, distressed, crying, and emotional. Of Leslie, Dr. Munaco said the defendant seemed distant and did not ask any questions. Dr. Gelbach said Leslie appeared engaged at first, but partway through the conversation, her
eyes were closed and she was not awake.
On Thursday, July 1st, a woman named Julie Runyon took the stand. Multiple news sources described her as Tate's great aunt, but all my other research has indicated she might actually be Tate's grandmother. In baby Jessalyn's obituary, Julie and her since-deceased husband Paul were listed as the baby's paternal grandparents, and in Paul's obituary, Jeremy is listed as his son, which would make Julie either Jeremy's mother or his stepmother. Julie told the court that Tate and his older brother, JT, stayed with her the weekend before Tate died. Besides a bruise on Tate's face, she said, he seemed happy and healthy. When Assistant State's Attorney Mara Mishler showed Julie photos of Tate in the hospital, covered in bruises and cuts, Julie cried on the stand as she testified that none of the injuries were present when she spent the weekend with the boys, saying,
I never saw bruising like that.
Were any of these injuries that appear on his face February 18, 2020, present on February 15th?
No.
Julie described Tate as a little clumsy like herself, but said he always
popped right back up.
Julie described how she would say goodbye to JT and Tate whenever they left her house.
I'd like to stand on the deck when they left, and Jeremy, even if it was cold out or something, he would roll down the back windows. I've always said that they loved me and they waved at me.
The same day, video was played for the jury of Leslie speaking with detectives at the hospital, telling them she didn't know how Tate's severe injuries had occurred. She made the suggestion that he could have been injured while wrestling with his brother, which he did often. Her attorney, Hugh Toner, really leaned into that theory, attempting to pin Tate's death on his brother, who was 7 when Tate died.
Playing with wrestling dolls on your table.
Right. Yes.
And that's what he did.
That's what he liked.
And that was long before Leslie was involved, correct?
Yes.
Julie, however, told the court that JT and Tate were well-behaved when they were with her, and that their wrestling play never became dangerous. As for Leslie, Julie, who rushed to the hospital as soon as she found out about Tate's condition on February 18th, said Leslie was already at the hospital when she arrived, and she never heard Leslie ask about Tate's condition or explain to anyone what happened to him. Leslie, she said, was also not in the room when Tate was declared brain dead.
Yeah, we all started crying.
Was Leslie in the room when those comments were initially made?
No.
Did she ever come into the room and say anything to anyone?
Yeah, she came in the doorway and she stood there and she goes, what?
Another witness that day was Sadie Kistler, a stay-at-home mom who was at the hospital when Tate was brought in. Sadie testified that she entered the waiting room bathroom to find Leslie passed out on the floor beneath the sink.
I was startled and walked out of the bathroom and blatantly said she was asleep on the bathroom floor.
According to Sadie's testimony, Leslie had to be carried out of the bathroom. Only one witness testified on Friday, July 1st, and that was Tate's father, Jeremy Thurman, who was by that time the ex-boyfriend of defendant Leslie Ann Jett. Jeremy was in obvious anguish on the stand, at times becoming emotional, sobbing, wailing, his face becoming red and pale by turns, and once, while listening to a recording of his former girlfriend speaking, he even threw up. When Jeremy was shown photos from Tate's 4th birthday in December of 2019, in which Tate's head was covered in bruises Leslie claimed were caused in an accident with a door, Jeremy broke down in tears. Describing Tate, Jeremy said,
like to watch cartoons, play with brother, sit and talk to his dad.
Prosecutors asked Jeremy about the morning of February 18th, 2020. Jeremy said Leslie told him that Tate wet his bed around 4:45 that morning, but she didn't mention any injuries at that time.
She said she took him potty, had wet the bed, and changed him into PJs. Nothing about Tate being injured.
Jeremy, who testified that he hadn't seen any bruises on Tate the previous evening, said he left for work shortly after that, and that as he always did, he checked in on Leslie around 7:45 a.m. to be sure his older son made it to school on time. Leslie, he said, texted him back at 7:46 a.m., simply saying,
up.
When prosecutors asked Jeremy about the phone call he received from Leslie regarding Tate's injury, he said he was at work in Champaign County when he got the call around 9:11 a.m.
That Tate wasn't breathing, and the paramedics were there.
Jeremy told the court that at first, he believed Leslie's story about Tate's fall on the floor, but he began to think she was lying as his son's condition grew worse. Jeremy testified about a doctor delivering him the terrible news.
The neurologist said that he didn't expect him to wake up.
Was the defendant with you when you got some of these updates?
She was specifically with me for that update.
Did you see her cry when you got these updates?
Not until I was very, very, very ill and crying.
The jury was shown screenshots of text messages between Leslie and Jeremy prior to Tate's death, in which Leslie expressed frustration and anger about being forced to watch Jeremy's 2 sons. The couple repeatedly argued in the messages about Tate's potty training accidents. Jeremy added that Tate had issues with wetting the bed, which he often did when Jeremy was away at work. Jeremy told the court that he
felt like she was blaming myself and my kids for not having enough free time.
In one of the text messages, Leslie wrote,
"Fuck watching Tate."
In another, she said,
"I want my house back."
After the July 4th long weekend, the prosecution played voicemails and jail phone calls for the jury in which they heard Leslie begging and whining for her sister Kelly and her ex-husband Aaron Jett to get her out of jail. According to prosecutors, Leslie made over 300 calls from jail prior to the trial. To her sister, Leslie insisted she didn't kill Tate and also threatened to kill herself if her ex didn't take the fall for her. She said,
"You need to get to the police station right now. Call the detectives and tell them."
In some of these phone calls, Leslie pleaded with her ex-husband to implicate himself in Tate's murder, again threatening suicide if he didn't. In one voicemail to Aaron, she said,
"I'm going to fucking kill myself. I already tried. You need to do this. Please, it's my life. It's not a joke."
During a phone call, Leslie begged Aaron,
"You have to tell them you were there."
His response was,
"You're trying to set me up."
That's why I'm out here doing everything I can, dude.
It's not gonna work. You have to tell them that you're there and you did it.
In a call to Aaron on February 24th, 2020, Leslie demanded,
"You fucking take this shit. I accidentally kicked Tate."
The shameless gall of this woman to assume her life was more important than Aaron's or anyone else's. Fortunately for Aaron, his supervisor, Jason Contreras, testified that Aaron was working all day on February 18th, beginning at 6 a.m. and continuing through the afternoon. Pediatrician Dr. Janning Petrak, a certified child abuse expert, also took the stand that day. Dr. Petrak treated Tate when he arrived at OSF Children's Hospital unresponsive. She testified that most four-year-olds commonly experience various bumps and bruises, but any injuries on the torso, ears, and the back of the legs may indicate child abuse.
Other than the abrasion on the chin, which could be accidental, the remaining bruises are highly suspicious for abuse. Injuries along the jawline are highly suspicious for abuse. Bruising anywhere on the soft part of the face, they don't happen accidentally.
Dr. Petrak spoke of bruises on Tate's face, stomach, back, and thighs, as well as
multiple abrasions
on one of his feet. When asked to describe what she saw in one photo of the little boy's face, she said,
"There's bruising on the left side of the forehead, extends into the hairline. There is an abrasion at the corner of the left eyelid."
Defense attorney Hugh Toner questioned Dr. Petrak about the possibility of Tate's injuries being caused by aggressive wrestling moves, once again clearly trying to pin the blame on Tate's older brother.
So it can cause one bruise on the head. That's what I would expect. I probably would expect a laceration, because when the scalp gets hit hard, it tends to split.
Dr. Petrak further posited that Tate's injuries were caused by
punching, kicking, stomping.
Other witnesses included Tate's maternal grandparents, Doug and Carol Kent, Tara Foley's mother and stepfather, who were licensed foster parents and therefore mandated reporters. The couple testified that JT and Tate spent every other weekend at their home. The last weekend the boys spent with the Kents was that of February 8, 2020. Doug described Tate as
his little buddy,
saying he was a good kid who just liked to have fun.
He liked to play outside on swings, cars. His favorite thing was for me to smell his feet.
Carol testified that while giving Tate a bath in October of 2019, she noticed a bump on his head, which she questioned her grandson about.
He said that Leslie had hit his head on the floor.
Carol didn't report it to DCFS, however, because she thought it was an accident and
wasn't thinking it was possible abuse.
Carol did take photos of other injuries she saw on her grandson, including some she noticed in December of 2019 at Tate's joint birthday party with JT. Those injuries included apparent bruising on his face and head and lacerations on his chin and neck. Previous evidence, including text messages between Leslie and Jeremy, indicated Leslie told Tate's father that Tate was injured by running into the side of a door. During their last weekend with both of the boys, 10 days before Tate was fatally injured, Carol took photos of
bruises and markings
she saw on Tate's face, later showing the pictures to detectives at the hospital. Regarding the reason neither Doug nor Carol reported potential abuse as mandated reporters, Doug said,
"What I understand is you have to see it. Could be indications of abuse, and I'm not sure."
WEEK pointed out that a 2020 Illinois DCFS mandated reporter manual does not mention the reporter must be present at the time of abuse to file a report. On the sixth day of the trial, July 7, 2021, forensic pathologist Dr. Amanda Humans testified about the five-hour autopsy she performed on Tate on February 24, 2020, after his organs were harvested for donation. During the autopsy, Dr. Yeomans discovered 260 external and internal injuries. 84 of those injuries were on Tate's head and face.
The amount of external injuries was extensive. His head, his face, his neck, chest, abdomen, genitals, back, buttocks, both arms, both legs.
The jury once again saw graphic photos of Tate's injuries, while Dr. Yeomans described each of them in detail, right down to the bruises found between Tate's ribs.
These are not common injuries for a child.
Well, are they common injuries for an adult?
No, they're not common injuries for adults either.
Both Dr. Yeomans and Dr. Petrak testified that several of Tate's injuries indicated that even though he suffered from a freshly broken clavicle, which limited the range of his arm's motion, he tried to protect himself from repeated punches and kicks, including some to his genitals. The prosecution, which called 17 witnesses in total, rested its case on the morning of Thursday, July 8th, handing the reins over to the defense. That afternoon, Leslie's legal team showed the jury footage from a police body cam in which East Peoria Detective Dale Orr was heard telling his supervisor over the phone that it was possible Tate was injured while wrestling with JT. I'll play the clip first, but I'll also read the quote, since it's not the most legible recording.
There's a table in the middle of the bedroom upstairs where the schoolwork is, and the chair is tipped over. I wonder if that same girl may have dressed or something, did her jump off of something onto Tate?
Detective Orr said,
"There's a table in the middle of the bedroom upstairs where the schoolwork is, and the chair is tipped over. I wonder if that 7-year-old, getting dressed or something, didn't jump off of something onto Tate."
The detective told his supervisor the house seemed normal, and the only thing that might stick out is all of the WWE toys and merchandise.
"However, I've seen this house so far, that is the only thing I can really pick up on. It's a living house, but it's not what you necessarily expect to find in a house full of abuse."
The detective said in that clip,
"Out of everything I've seen in this house so far, that is the only thing that I can totally pick up on. It's a lived-in house, but it's not what you would necessarily expect to find in a house with abuse."
However, Assistant State's Attorney Sarah Schreier confirmed on cross that the detective had not, at the time, seen Tate's injuries.
"You hadn't spoken to the doctors?
No.
To any of them? Correct?
Correct.
You had not received any information about the rate of bleeding that the doctors observed in Tate, correct?"
"That's correct."
The same day, the defense recalled Jeremy Thurman to the stand, where attorney Michael Brandt asked about JT and Tate's love for wrestling. Jeremy insisted JT knew the dangerous moves should only be done by professional wrestlers, not at home. The next morning, they called to the stand Dr. Brad Bushman, a social psychologist who specialized in the effects of violence in the media, trying to back up their theory that 7-year-old JT was the real killer. Dr. Bushman told the court that research showed violent video games, like the wrestling games JT used, could increase aggressive behavior in children.
"Young children, especially under 8, have a difficult time distinguishing real from fantasy. Everything seems real to them. You can even tell them it's fake, but young children cannot reliably distinguish between reality and fantasy."
While they had suggested earlier they may call JT himself to the stand, fortunately, they did not subject the little boy to that trauma. After losing his mom and his little brother, he's been through more than enough. The final witness in the trial was Leslie Jett herself, who took the stand on Friday, July 9th. Although she had remained utterly emotionless throughout the rest of the trial, like a reptile, on the stand, she wiped away tears while being shown photos and videos of happy family holidays and events. Leslie described Tate as her
little buddy,
saying he was always willing to help out and that they even shared a secret handshake. She said she was the primary caretaker of JT, Tate, and her own son, and that she often did worksheets and flashcards with Tate while JT was at school. She testified that they even did worksheets the morning Tate was taken to the hospital. The prosecution was quick to point out how that portion of her story had changed. She originally told police that Tate didn't get out of bed that morning until JT left for school. But in court, she said Tate was awake and doing worksheets before his brother left. When asked if she injured Tate on the morning of February 18th, Leslie insisted,
"I did not."
She stuck to her original story, saying she was cleaning the fish tank in another room when
he came running
into the kitchen from his second floor bedroom, slipped in a puddle of water, and fell.
"I heard him coming, I heard him fall, and he was laying on the floor."
Leslie testified that after Tate fell, she turned him over, saw he wasn't breathing, and called 911. Her panicked emergency call, in which she audibly gave Tate CPR, was played for the jury.
"Come out with me. Come out.
Leslie was not questioned on the stand about Tate's injuries other than one reference Mara Mishler made to bruises evident in photos of Tate taken since Leslie and her young son moved in with Jeremy and his sons during the summer of 2019. When questioned about the text messages depicting her anger and frustration over being required to care for Jeremy's children, Leslie acknowledged the messages, some of which indicated Leslie believed Tate's bathroom accidents were actually purposeful. In the messages, Leslie complained she was overwhelmed by both Tate's potty training issues and the fact that she was constantly required to care for three children, two of whom were not even hers. Ms. Mishler read aloud one text in which Leslie told Jeremy,
"Things are going to blow up real soon. This is not how I intended to live my life."
Leslie's response to the prosecutor was,
"Correct."
Leslie insisted, however, that the emotions she expressed in the text messages were indicative only of her mental state at the time she sent them, not her feelings for Tate overall. When the prosecutor asked her to confirm her position that she had no idea what happened to Tate the morning he was taken to the hospital, Leslie again answered,
"Correct."
In its closing argument on Monday, July 12th, the defense said the state had not proven its case. They nailed home the idea that JT caused the injuries to his younger brother due to his infatuation with the WWE. Michael Brandt argued,
"People getting stomped on by other people's feet? That's what WWE is all about."
As for Leslie's pathetic phone calls to her ex-husband Aaron, the defense said they proved nothing. Brandt said,
"We heard a desperate person who was pleading some nonsensical way. There's no admission of guilt, just admission of desperation."
At the time, Brandt said, Leslie was in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day.
"The phone calls that we heard a desperate person who was basically pleading for some, even ridiculous, nonsensical way to get out of jail. How in the world would that scheme ever work? It certainly wouldn't, and anyone that was in their right mind thinking at the time would even propose it."
During the prosecution's closing argument, Sarah Schreier reminded the jury of multiple medical experts'
fundamental
and rock-solid testimony. She presented a timeline of events she insisted pointed directly at Leslie Ann Jett and no one else as the only person responsible for Tate's injuries, and she argued that JT couldn't be responsible, as it would have taken at least 4.5 minutes to inflict all 260 injuries found on Tate's body.
"This was hard work, killing this little boy. This was an investment of considerable time and a lot of effort into beating this little boy to death. This was a job that would wear a person out, and she wants you to believe a 7-year-old did it."
Tate's beating death, Ms. Schreier told the jury, was
an act of extreme force and extreme anger.
After closing arguments, the judge turned the case over to the jury for deliberations, and after only 80 minutes, they returned with a verdict. 35-year-old Leslie Ann Jett rocked a little in her chair, once again showing no emotion, while Judge Paul Gilfillan read the verdicts. Guilty on one count of first-degree murder with intent to kill or cause great bodily harm to a child under 12. Guilty on a second count of first-degree murder, knowing her attack on Tate held the strong probability of death or great harm. And guilty of aggravated battery to a child under 12. Leslie was found not guilty on a third count of first-degree murder, requiring she knew her assault would cause Tate's death. However, this won't mitigate the maximum sentence Leslie can receive, which is still 100 years in prison. Leslie's sentencing hearing is scheduled for 9 a.m. on Friday, September 17, 2021. In the meantime, she was remanded back to the Tazewell County Jail, and her $3 million bond was revoked. The judge has ordered a pre-sentence investigation, which is a process during which the probation department gathers detailed information about the convicted in order to assist the judge in determining an appropriate sentence. As part of the investigation, multiple factors will be considered, including Leslie's age, race, gender, the details of her offense, criminal history, her physical and mental health, family history, attitude, education, employment, history of alcohol or drug use, and victim impact statements. I sincerely hope Jeremy, Tara's family, and everyone else who loves Tate pours their heart into their statements, and the judge throws the book at her. Although she did not react in the courtroom when her verdicts were read, when she was led from the room to wait for the elevator, Leslie was overheard releasing a short, high-pitched cry. I want to devote the end part of the episode to remembering Tate Thurman as the fun-loving, energetic, sweet, silly boy he was. Tate loved singing, dancing, being a goofball, and cartoons. He was a big fan of Lightning McQueen from the Disney Cars series, as well as the TV shows PJ Masks and Paw Patrol. He especially loved sharing his older brother's interest in professional wrestling. He should be turning 6 on December 3rd, 2021, but instead, Tate will forever be remembered as a tiny, precious 4-year-old with fine blonde hair and a giant, sunny smile. I want to play a little audio from some videos of Tate at about age 2, which were posted online by the same person who created the GoFundMe for Tate's headstone, Christina, who Tate called Watina. Here he is, excited to be blowing bubbles. This is Tate playing with a sound effect toy.
Hey, Tina!
What? Ew! Hey. What do you say? What do you say?
Excuse me!
Ew! Yuck! Excuse you! Crazy boy.
I'm okay.
You're okay. What? Oh my gosh, Tate, yuck. Excuse you. Whoa, crazy.
Finally, this adorable clip shows little Tate running around the room, over the moon excited because he thought the tag from his Cars-themed outfit was a personal invitation from Lightning McQueen himself.
What do you got, Tate?
Shatina, tell her what it is.
Meeting's over. What? Lightning McQueen's
station. Oh my gosh, it's Lightning McQueen's station? Is it invitation?
Yeah. Lightning
McQueen
station!
Yes, we're invited! Oh yeah!
Lightning McQueen
station! Yeah, we're so lucky! Got a station with our clothes!
Lightning McQueen!
Oh yeah!
Lightning
McQueen
station!
Uh-huh. Life's good, huh?
Lightning McQueen station!
Oh, yeah.
Rest well, Tate. I hope you and your big sister, Jessalyn, are safe in your mommy's arms. As for those of us here, we'll never forget you. My sources for this episode were Peoria Public Radio, Central Illinois Proud, The Pekin Times, The Journal Star, The Tazewell Chronicle, Heart of Illinois ABC, WEEK.com, CBS Chicago, Facebook, The Tazewell County Circuit Court Online Portal, Legacy.com, and the Illinois Criminal Justice System Policies and Procedures. I will continue following Tate's case on Suffer the Little Children blog, where I'll make sure to post once the sentencing hearing takes place. May Tate get the justice he deserves. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another story. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com. where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod and on Twitter and TikTok at STLC Pod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music, and all music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildrenpod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.